pay much attention. I'd guess about 11:30 or so. Did you see anybody else in the house? Or outside it? He thought for a while. Yes, as a matter of fact, I did. As I was driving away, I saw Baby Herman's stooge. You know the one, the rabbit, Roger Rabbit, walking up the drive. That dragged Roger back into the ball game. He hopped bolt upright. I braced myself for trouble, but Roger only puffed forth an innocuous balloon containing a vague reference to important matters elsewhere and fled out the door. "Queer fellow, your assistant," said Sleaze. "You know, when I first met him, he reminded me of someone. Now I know who. Roger Rabbit. Do you see the resemblance?" "Yeah, now that you mention it," I said casually. "I do. The both of them could be twins." I bid Sleaze a quick farewell, and went out to collar Roger before he did something dumb. About as easy as changing the course of the Mississippi River. I searched for several blocks in every direction, but couldn't find hide nor hair of the skedaddled bunny. On the off chance he might surprise me and do something reasonable, I hot-footed it over to the Persian delicatessen where he'd left the scroll. I don't know which smelled worse, the deli's cuisine or a dead camel. Not that it mattered, since they were probably one and the same. The deli's owner, a middle-aged greaseball named Abu Ben something, spoke English about as well as I spoke Tunisian. He tried semaphore, but I couldn't read his waving arms either. We finally hit on charades. I got through to him by pretending to read a napkin wound around a fat wiener. He ran into the back room and returned with the scroll, plus some old codger who should have been hanging in the front window with the rest of the skinny, brown, wrinkled sausages. The old galoot handed me a sheet of paper with marks on it that looked like they had been scratched there by what eventually wound up as the main ingredient in the chicken salad. I finally got the key to deciphering it when I realized that half the O's were grease spots. If you ignored them, the message came clear. "Beware," it said. "Great tragedy will result should this fiendish device ever fall into the hands of a toon." Imagine that, a cursed tea kettle. Though, oddly enough, the scroll's dire prediction had come true. The tea kettle had fallen into the hands of a toon, and great tragedy had resulted. Maybe the tea kettle really did carry a curse. And maybe Santa Claus also swept out my chimney for me every Christmas. I slipped the deli owner a fin for his trouble, and shagged it on out to the sidewalk before the deli's zingy smell did permanent damage to my nose. I debated whether to pursue clues or keep after Roger. Clues won. I made a few phone calls, and in no time located the messenger service that had delivered the stolen artwork to Hiram Toner's gallery. The place, called what else but Speedy Messenger Service, told me somebody had dropped the artwork at their office and had paid cash in advance for delivery to Toner. Their records didn't show the sender's name. I sweet-talked a secretary into giving me the name and home address of the clerk on duty when the sender came in the hope that maybe he could provide me a description. When I came out of the messenger service, it was a cool, sunny day, and there wasn't a toon anywhere in sight. It made me want to chuck what I was doing, drive back by the Persian deli, pick up a roast goat sandwich and a bottle of Camel Whiz wine, and head out to the nearest stand of timber for a solitary picnic and drunk. I flipped a coin. It came up Dominic DeGreasy. I resisted an urge to make it best 2 out of 3, and headed off to do my duty. 28. I found Dominic DeGreasy stalking through the syndicate's production studio, glaring his workforce to higher levels of productivity. The few people crazy enough to ask him a question got, instead of an answer, a public dressing down for not knowing their jobs. Quite a manager, DeGreasy. "Got a minute, Mr. DeGreasy?" I said to him.
"Don't bring your problems to me," he said, mistaking me for one of his employees. "That's why I pay you good money. To know how to deal with problems."
"No problem, Mr. DeGreasy. Just a few questions. I'm Eddie Valiant. Remember me? The guy looking into your brother's murder? The guy who's going to return your tea kettle?"
"Oh, sure, Valiant." He looped an arm the size of an oak tree around my shoulders.
You got a line on my tea kettle yet?
I nodded. Maybe, just maybe. Can we go someplace private and discuss it?
Sure, sure, in here.
He led me into the employees' lounge. When he entered, every employee inside walked out.
Respect, he said, jerking a thumb toward the retreating multitude. That's what it takes to run a big company. Respect. You either got it, or you ain't.
And you got it?
In spades. There's not a worker in this company who doesn't respect Dominic DeGreasy.
The coffee machine showed its respect by serving him up a freebie when he wrapped it with his fist.
Tell me what you found out about the tea kettle.
In a minute. First, I've got some other stuff to go over with you. Stuff that bears directly on the case.
Stuff? What kind of stuff? I want that tea kettle, period.
And your brother's murderer. You want him too, don't you?
Oh, sure. Sure I want him too. It's just that I sometimes forget what I want more. Rocco was a great one for always taking care of me. It's hard for me to keep my priorities straight now that I have to take care of myself.
He walloped the candy dispenser, but it refused to knuckle under to management pressure. Must have had a stronger union than the coffee machine. On the day he died, your brother wrote a check to Hiram Toner at the High Tone Gallery. The check went to pay for return of that stolen artwork I found photos of in Rocco's office. Rocco mention anything about that to you?
No. Rocco took care of the money. I took care of discipline.
Dominic stuck his gargantuan hand into the candy machine's delivery slot. The rankest amateur soothsayer could have predicted what would happen next. He was going to get that massive paw of his stuck up there, and sure enough he did. In a lot of ways, I hated dealing with Dominic DeGreasy worse than dealing with a toon. At least with a toon, you knew enough to expect the ridiculous. With Dominic, you expected the normal, but got the ridiculous anyway. I put a shoulder to the machine. Two healthy grunts, and I set him free. Although for as much gratitude as he showed, I'm sorry I bothered. I should have left it on him and let him explain to his respectful employees how he came to be wearing their candy machine for an ID bracelet. Did Rocco have many dealings with Hiram Toner? I asked him.
Enough. He had arrangements with most of the art dealers around. If anything interesting turned up on the market, legit or otherwise, the dealers gave him first crack. If he liked it, he bought it. No questions asked.
After getting caught once, you'd think even the numbest numbskull would get the message. But some numbskulls never learn. It took Dominic less than 2 seconds to get in up to his elbow again. I got him loose, dug some change out of my pockets, and pumped it into the coin slot. You know Sid Sleaze? I asked.
Never heard of him.
Dominic stabbed at the buttons with his broad, lumpy finger. He hit 2 buttons at once, but only 1 bar came out. He tore off the wrapper, jammed the bar into his mouth, and swallowed it whole. How about Sid Baumgartner? I asked, trying Sleaze's real name.
Yeah, I know Baumgartner.
Dominic straightened out the only 2 pictures in the room. One of him, one of his brother Rocco, with a metal plaque that said, Our Founder, bolted under each.
This Baumgartner approached the syndicate a bunch of times with an offer to buy out one of our contract players.
Which one? His sandpaper voice gained another layer of grittiness.
Always the same. Roger Rabbit. I wanted to go for it, but Rocco told me he would never sell that rabbit in 1 million years. I told him he was nuts. Baumgartner offered a lot more than I thought the rabbit was worth. But Rocco refused to even consider the idea. He never told me why, but I always suspected Jessica was behind it.
Strange. When I asked Rocco if anybody had ever wanted to buy out Roger's contract, he said no. Any idea why he lied? A few employees drifted into the coffee room, saw Dominic, and promptly drifted right out again.
Beats me. Rocco had a peculiar obsession with that rabbit.
Rocco ever mention anything about Jessica's starring in a pornographic comic book? His lips curled back across his teeth in a leer.
She'd do that? No kidding? I told Rocco that woman was a doxy. I told him, but he never listens. Now, he never mentioned nothing about any comic book like that. Not that he would. He was nuts over that broad.
He leaned close to me. His breath smelled like he'd been gnawing on garlic cloves.
I hear she's the leading candidate to take the fall for Roger Rabbit's murder. I hear the cops think they can make it stick. That the angle you're playing? You out to pin it on her, too? Because if you are, I'll back you 100%. She caused Rocco a lot of heartache, and I want her to pay.
I'll do my best. By the way, I said casually, did you know Jessica's also interested in your tea kettle? If you've ever seen a matador wave a red flag in front of a bull, you have some idea how Dominic de Grisi responded to that one. He did everything but slobber and paw the carpet.
It's not hers, he yelled. It belongs to me and Rocco. What the hell does she want with it?
According to her, it's solid gold. Dominic's face lightened from bright crimson to pastel pink to its normal pasty white, and he gave out with a chuckle that sounded like the croak of a dying frog.
Solid gold, she says it's solid gold. Boy, oh boy, is she in for a surprise. It's nothing but an ordinary tea kettle. That's it. Nothing but plain old metal.
He whipped out his fat leather wallet and waved it in my direction.
Whatever she offered you, I'll double it.
I didn't have the heart to tell him that there was no way on earth he could double the kind of reward Jessica had promised me. Instead, I assured him that as soon as I got my grubby hands on it, the tea kettle would be his. I found Roger the last place I would have thought to look. Back in my apartment, his feet hanging over one arm of my sofa, his ears drooped limply over the other. The residue from his deep funk had turned his white fur the same shade of blue as a careless granny's home rinse. Quite the pleasant sight to walk in on. Home sweet home, assuming you lived in a funeral parlor.
You sure lit out of Sleaze's place in a hurry, I said. I got kind of worried. I thought you might be starting to disintegrate on me. You're not, are you?
The last time I saw eyes with that much pleading and despair in them, they were staring out at me from inside a cage at the city pound.
I didn't kill Rocco, he said. I just don't have it in me.
Sure, you know that, and I know that. But prove it to the rest of the world. Maybe Sleaze is lying about seeing you there the night Rocco died. I don't know why he would, but it's possible. Maybe Jessica's lying, too. I don't know. That's what we have to find out. Who's telling the truth and who's not? That's why we call this a mystery. Otherwise, if everything was cut and dried, we'd call it an unvarnished truth. I passed out whiskey and cigars. We both chugged down and lit up. Look, I got us a great lead, I said. I found the messenger service that delivered the stolen artwork to Hiram Toner. I'm on my way over to see the clerk who took the order. Why not come along? Roger's word balloons came out filled with cigar smoke. He had to repeat his answer again after he'd exhaled the smoke, so I could read it.
No, to tell you the truth, I kind of lost my taste for it. You go ahead. Investigate the case however you want to. Without me. I'll just wait around here for your final report.
So there was a God in heaven after all, and he did respond to prayers. What more could I want? The rabbit off my back? Freedom to pursue the case any way I saw fit. Yet it failed to give me the rush I would have expected. Lord, let it be a case of the grip, delirium tremens, terminal scurvy, anything but the nagging suspicion that I might actually be starting to like the dipsy-doodle cottontail. Sure, sure, I said, if that's the way you want it. That's the way I want it. When I sized Roger up, he seemed somehow smaller, as though some brute had wailed 5 pounds of stuffing out of him. Try as hard as I might, I just couldn't help feeling sorry for him. I left him and went into my bedroom. In my top dresser drawer, Underneath my dress white boxer shorts, I found the special deputy's badge I got awarded a few years back, after successfully completing one of those rare jobs where I found myself on the sunny side of the law. I polished it on my sleeve and pinned it into one of my old wallets. I went back out into the living room, where the rabbit was again draped across the sofa. "Stand up," I told him. He blinked extra slowly.
"What?"
I said, "Stand up. I've got something for you."
"Can't you give it to me here?"
"No, I can't. Now will you stand up, or do I have to help you?"
"Sure, sure, whatever you say."
He stood up, but with such rotten posture that he resembled one of those collapsible wooden rulers that fold into about 14 sections. I poked him in the chest. "Snap to," I said. And he did pull out a few of his kinks, although he still retained about as many bends as a road map of a con man's morals. "You've been a great help to me in this case," I said, stretching the truth so far that if it ever sprang back and hit me in the chest, I'd be a dead man for sure. "I think you should have some official recognition. So, I want to swear you in as my assistant."
"You mean it? As your official assistant?"
"Raise your paw and repeat after me." He raised his paw. "I, state your name."
"I, Roger Rabbit."
"Promise to uphold law and order."
"Promise to uphold law and order."
"And to fight for truth, justice, and the American way."
"And to fight for truth, justice, and the American way."
I handed him the wallet. He opened it and saw the badge inside. The last remnants of his blue funk flaked off his fur, and he stood before me as pure and white as one of those knights that fight bathroom scum on TV.
"I don't know what to say."
He jammed the wallet into his hip pocket.
"This is one of the happiest moments of my life."
"No more gloomy Gus?"
"You've seen the last of him."
"No more deep depressions when a witness takes a pot shot at you?"
"From now on, I'm strictly hard shell. Let them call me what they will."
"Then let's get to work. We'll start by interviewing that messenger service clerk. What's more, you ask the questions."
"You mean it? Honest? I ask the questions?"
"That's what I said."
"Oh, boy. Stand back and make way for Roger Rabbit, special deputy, barreling through."
He took off out the door so fast, he left behind a hefty shock of the whiz lines tunes produce when they blast off in a hurry. I kicked what I could under the sofa, stuffed the rest into a closet, and went out after him. The messenger service clerk, Mrs. Ida Kuntz, lived in a house that looked like it had been built by a bakery school dropout. It had gingerbread trim, ladyfinger shutters, a mint frosting front lawn, and a vanilla wafer walkway. The gutters were peppered with stunned woodpeckers who had taken a whack at the milk chocolate roof, only to bash a beak against solid slate. A brightly colored carpet of the kind Arabians use when they fly economy class lay draped over the porch railing. Two others hung from a clothesline in the side yard. As I watched, a window opened, and a portly woman dumped the contents of a dustpan into the flower bed outside. The toon flowers living there coughed and gagged horribly, but as soon as the woman retreated into the house, the Ritz brothers of the pansy set exchanged their hacking for a swell case of the giggles. The front door was the strong, solid kind you like to put between you and the cold, cruel world. I gave it a hearty rap, knowing I wouldn't have to worry about winding up with my hand buried to the wrist in splintered wood. How Mrs. Kuntz ever came to be associated with the speedy messenger service, I'll never know, unless she was an old-line employee who had started with them when they used to ride horses and called themselves the Pony Express. She took forever to answer the door, another forever to examine my license, and yet a third forever to show us into her parlor. She offered us a beer, and I would have accepted but didn't want to waste the rest of the day waiting for her to return from the kitchen. "Thanks anyway," I said, "but we just have a few questions to ask, and we'll be on our way."
"Whatever I can do to help," she said, obligingly enough.
She picked up her knitting and went to work, putting her single daily stitch into a sweater that had gone out of style 20 years ago.
I nodded at Roger and waited for him to begin. He stared at old Mrs. Kuntz. His feet did a fast tap shuffle straight out of flying down to Rio, and he sent up two balloons. One contained a hem, the other a haw. He grabbed them out of the air, stuffed them under his coat, and jerked his head in the direction of the hallway. "Would you excuse us, please?" I asked Mrs. Kuntz, "while I confer with my partner?" She nodded absently, too intent upon getting her sweater done in time for the New Year's party celebrating the start of the next century to pay us much mind.
"I have a problem," said the rabbit, once we were out of the woman's eye and earshot. "I'm supposed to ask the questions here."
"Right. So what's the problem?" His cheeks flushed red.
"I don't know what questions to ask."
He turned his paws, palms upward at shoulder level, and tilted his head. I patted his arm. "My boy, you just relax and watch the master at work." We rejoined the old lady. "You work for the Speedy Messenger Service," I asked, "right?" She mulled my question over in her mind for a couple of minutes.
"That's correct."
Since I hadn't brought my overnight bag, I skipped any further background stuff and got right to the nitty-gritty. "A few days ago, you accepted a parcel for delivery to the High Tone Gallery of Comic Art, a parcel about so big by so high." I sized it for her with my hands. She nodded, but I couldn't tell if that was because she remembered it or because she had fallen asleep. "Can you tell me anything about the person who dropped it off?" She looked at me, then tended to her knitting for a while.
"It was a woman," she said finally.
"Human or toon?"
"I'm sorry, but I really couldn't tell. She didn't say anything, and she wore a veil."
"What else was she wearing?"
"Nothing unusual. A long, dark, baggy dress."
"How tall was she?"
"I really don't know. I was sitting down at the time, and she was standing up. It's hard for me to judge heights in that situation."
Now it was my turn to head signal Roger out into the hall. "I'm out of questions myself," I confessed. "Can you think of anything else I can ask her?" He scratched his head.
"Try asking her how the woman smelled."
"How she smelled?"
"Sure. Women often notice other women's perfumes. If she was wearing something distinctive, it could be a clue."
"How she smelled?"
"Try it. You never know," he said.
So I tried it. "You notice how this woman smelled?" Ida put down her knitting and looked at me like I had just made an elephant appear in the middle of her parlor.
"Why, come to think of it, I do remember something unusual about that."
Roger's grin tickled the bases of both his ears. "You do?" I said. "You remember something about how she smelled?"
"Yes. She had a very pungent odor about her, like she hadn't taken a bath for a while, the way some of these younger girls smell nowadays. Positively disgusting. When I was young, I had to cart water in from a well and heat it over a stove, but at least I took a bath."
I almost walked right over and gave Roger a hug. Too bad he wasn't going to be around much longer. Another few months of working with me, and he might, just might, turn into a fairly competent gumshoe. Nothing to compare to a human, of course, but better than most any toon. Thanks to him and his perfect question, I now knew enough to crack this lousy case open like a rotten walnut. 29. I pulled up outside the DeGreasy gallery. "You know what Little Rock DeGreasy looks like?" I asked Roger.
"Yes," said the rabbit. "I've seen him around."
"Good. You wait out here on the street. When you see Little Rock come out of the gallery, you tail him. Don't let him out of your sight. Clear?" The rabbit's nod started out fairly enthusiastic, but rapidly wound down to nothing more than a slight bob in the tip of his ear. "What's the problem?" I asked, ignoring whatever I have in the way of better judgment. The rabbit burped out a confused jumble of words which he rearranged by hand into a cogent statement.
"I'm your official assistant, right?"
"You've got the badge to prove it."
"Correct. Therefore, as official assistant, I should get meaningful assignments, stuff with gristle to it, and the aroma of danger."
"You and me both, Buster. Unfortunately, the private eye business just doesn't work that way. This is about as action-packed as it gets. I'd hate to tell you how many hours I've spent waiting for somebody to come out of somewhere so I could follow him to somewhere else and wait some more. You want wham-bam-slam detective work? Stick with the comics. You want to be bored out of your skull? Hang around real life with me." My message must have gotten through, since the rabbit smoothed the leftover nod out of his ear, climbed out of the car, and slouched into a doorway just across from the gallery. He tugged his hat down to within a finger's width of his eyes, turned up his collar, and dangled a smoke from his lower lip. I stuck my fist out the window at him, thumb up. From there, I drove to Carol Masters's studio. I knocked, but nobody answered. Never one to stand on convention, I opened the door and walked in. Carol was bent over a light table examining negatives. I picked up one of her props, a rubber mask that looked like the result of breeding broom Hilda the Witch to a warthog, put it in front of my face, tapped her shoulder and said, "Boo," when she turned around. She had a semicircular contraption over her head that magnified her eyes enough to startle me more than I startled her.
"Valiant," she said.
"I might have known. It's just your level of humor."
"Then you should have laughed."
I lobbed the mask onto a nearby table. "It might be the last chuckle you get for a while."
"No more Mr. Nice Guy. I see."
She removed her wraparound magnifier and turned off the light table.
"From your crusty demeanor, I assume we've reached the point in our relationship where you get tough."
She collected her negatives and slid them gently into an envelope.
"Where you punch me around until I spill my guts."
She must have halfway believed her smart alecky crack. She visibly cringed when I reached into my breast pocket, expecting me to pull out my rubber hose, I suppose. Instead, I hauled out something that would hurt her a lot worse. One of the photos I'd gotten from Rocco's office. I snapped it to attention in front of her perky nose.
"Recognize this?"
She gave it barely a glance.
"Sure. It's a strip I shot a few years back. So what?"
"It's also one of the pieces of artwork stolen from DeGreasy's gallery."
"I repeat, so what?"
"When I first saw it, when I found it in Rocco's office, it looked very familiar to me. It took me a while to remember where I had seen it before. Then it came to me. I saw it in your apartment. It was one of the prints you were developing in your closet."
She said nothing, so I turned up the heat a notch to see if that would make her boil. "This morning I talked to a speedy messenger service clerk who accepted the artwork for delivery to Hiram Toner. She remembered that the woman who dropped it off smelled bad. She assumed it was because the woman didn't take baths. She didn't know the real reason was because the woman keeps her wardrobe hanging right outside her photo lab, and her clothes pick up the smell of photographic chemicals. It all sifts down to one tidy conclusion. You stole your own stuff. You duplicated the negatives and the prints and used Hiram Toner as a middleman to peddle the copies as originals."
She looked at me without blinking.
"Sure, I did it. That was the only way I could get what was rightly mine. As I told you, my contract with Rocco specified that he owned the prints and negatives of everything I shot for him. He took the better stuff, framed it, and sold it through his art gallery, but refused to cut me in on the profits.
She walked across the studio, winding up in front of a backdrop that pictured a sylvan glade, with green trees and clean water and pure air. I took it to be some never-never fantasy land, the world of the future, until I realized it was a decade-old backdrop, and was really the world of the past.
One day I offered to watch the gallery for Little Rock, while he wined and dined a prospective client. While he was gone, I photographed his key, and later had a duplicate made. I went back several days after and helped myself to a number of my early works. I reproduced the prints, duplicated the negatives, and set out to sell the copies as real. I got into trouble my very first try. I gave my first set to Hiram Toner. He has a reputation as someone willing to deal in that kind of merchandise. I told him outright the stuff was stolen. I told him to peddle it to out-of-towners. So what does he do? He offers it for sale to Rocco himself. Naturally, Rocco recognized it immediately for what it was. With his resources, it didn't take him long to find out where it came from. That's the real reason he called me the night he died. To tell me he knew I had stolen his stuff, and that he was going to have me jailed for it.
Lucky for you, he didn't last through until morning.
If you're insinuating I made my own luck, you're wrong. I didn't kill him.
You did go to see him that night, though, didn't you? She leaned up against a phony palm tree. A phony coconut jostled loose and put a phony lump on a phony sheik, sitting in a pile of phony sand.
No, I didn't.
I stared her straight in the eye. I say you did. I say you went to Rocco's after he called and shot him to keep him from turning you into the cops. I say you then went to Roger's place and shot him too, leaving the DeGreasy murder weapon behind so Roger would take the fall for Rocco's murder.
It's not true, she said with a thickly clogged voice. I didn't leave my place all night.
Then how do you explain this? I pulled out the rubber squeeze frog. I found this outside Roger's house the night he died. Photographers use these to make their subjects smile, don't they? I squeezed it and smiled nastily. Tell me who else in this case is likely to have a rubber squeeze frog on them, and I'll let you off the hook.
She took the frog and squeezed it. It stuck out its tongue at her. She sat in a director's chair and set the frog on the arm beside her so I had two sets of eyes staring at me. One set real, one set rubber, and not the slightest trace of life in either one. All right. I did go to Rocco's place that night, and to Roger's place too, but it wasn't the way you said. I didn't kill anybody. Not Rocco, and certainly not Roger. I went to Rocco's to beg him to go easy on me. I knew he had me, and I was scared. I was just about to ring the bell when I heard a shot from inside. I stepped back into the bushes, just as Roger Rabbit came charging out, a gun in his paw. Roger ran past me, down to his car, and drove away. I didn't know exactly what had happened, but I had a pretty good hunch. I peeked through the window in Rocco's study. Rocco lay dead across his desk. I stumbled back to my car and drove around for a while, trying to sort out my options. Finally, I decided to visit Roger at home. I wanted to tell him I knew what he had done and would help him in any way he wanted, with getaway money, a hideout, an alibi, whatever he figured he needed. I parked my car around the corner from his bungalow. I got out and went to the door just in time to see Jessica Rabbit ring the doorbell. Roger answered it, and she went in.
Roger was still alive when Jessica got there?
He sure was. I didn't want Jessica to hear what I had to tell Roger, so I didn't ring the bell. I crouched outside the living room window to wait until Jessica came out. That's when my frog must have fallen out of my pocket. I waited there for nearly half an hour. Then a bunch of things happened in rapid succession. Somebody started to play the piano. I heard a pair of loud voices and then a shot. The door opened a crack, something came flying out, and the door slammed shut. I peeked in through the window and saw Roger lying dead across the banister. I expected to see Jessica standing over him, but I didn't. She was nowhere in sight.
Did you see anyone else in there?
No, no one. I beat it out of there as quickly as I could. That's the truth. Judging from what I saw, Roger shot Rocco, and Jessica shot Roger.
That seems to be the general consensus. This object that came sailing out the front door. What was it? Did you see?
Nothing much. An ordinary tea kettle.
A marching band could have taken a quick-step cadence from my loudly thumping heart. What became of it?
I picked it up on my way past and threw it into the trunk of my car, along with my camera stuff. As far as I know, it's still in there.
Her mouth twisted sideways, the way it would if somebody grabbed her by forehead and chin and wrung her dry.
Are you going to report me to the police?
Depends.
On what?
On a lot of things. On how the case breaks. On how well you cooperate from now on. On how much of what you've told me turns out to be fact versus fiction. On whether there's a full moon tonight. She didn't take kindly to my humor.
You're going to leave this hanging over my head, aren't you? You really are a louse, Valiant. A genuine grade-A weasel.
I've been called worse. I've been called better, too. Though I think the ones who call me worse have a firmer fix on the real me. Now, how about you give me the keys to your car? I want to take a close-up look at that tea kettle. She reached into her jeans, pulled out a key, and tossed it over. Although I don't think she believed I meant it, I wished her a good day. I walked down the hall, turned, and tiptoed back to her apartment. I put my ear to her door. I heard her pick up the phone and dial it. I didn't bother to listen to her conversation. I knew well enough who she was calling, and I knew why. I went downstairs, found her car parked out on the street, and opened the trunk. Sure enough, there, buried beneath a pile of photographic paraphernalia, sat my phantom tea kettle. In its pictures, it looked like an ordinary dime store tea kettle, but not in person. You hear people say they don't make things like they used to. In the tea kettle department, they hadn't made one like this for 1,000 years. It had intricate ornamental doodads and curlicues inscribed over every square inch of it. It had the solid heft of Crazy Cat's brick. Its top fit tighter than the door to Scrooge McDuck's vault. It was ancient and well constructed, but so were my grandmother's false teeth. What made this so much more valuable? I put Carol's car key into her mailbox, tucked the tea kettle under my arm, and headed for my office. 30.
I set the tea kettle on my desk and examined it from every angle. No secret compartments that I could see. I pulled out my pocket knife, flipped out the heavy blade, and scraped away a layer of metal. All I got for my trouble was more metal. No gold underneath here. Not unless some medieval alchemist had found a way to turn it back to lead. I scraped a few bumps off the handle, but they were just that. Bumps, not jewels. I leaned back in my chair and considered the possibilities. Maybe this wasn't the actual tea kettle. Maybe somebody had substituted this worthless piece of junk for the real thing. Or maybe the tea kettle had some other significance. Maybe it was the key to some illicit drug smuggling ring. Maybe it had come into the country loaded with opium. I picked it up and turned it over. On the bottom, I discovered what appeared to be more Persian writing. I had a hunch it probably said, "Made in Japan," but I copied the inscription into my notebook anyway. Just then the phone rang. It was Roger, so excited I had to hold the phone away from my ear to keep his word balloons from stinging my earlobes when they came zipping out.
"It worked just the way you said it would," he bellowed. "I positioned myself just outside Little Rock's gallery. I could see Little Rock through the gallery window. You had been gone maybe an hour when he got a phone call. He talked a few moments and hung up quite upset. He rushed out and got into his car. You'll never guess who he went to see."
I knew perfectly well, but I let Roger surprise me anyway.
"I can't imagine." "Sid Sleaze!" Roger exclaimed. "He stayed in there with Sleaze for the better part of an hour."
"Did he have something with him when he came out?" I asked. "A small box? Or maybe an envelope?" I could tell from Roger's silence I had just impressed the fuzzy socks off him.
As a matter of fact, he did, Roger said, reverentially. It was a large envelope. He took it with him to his house. I'm calling from a phone booth nearby. What do you want me to do?
I got the address. Wait for me there, I said. I'll be right over. And Roger, one other thing.
Yes?
It's all downhill now. On the way to Little Rocks, I stopped first at the Persian Deli. I bought a falafel sandwich and gave Abu Ben a copy of the writing on the bottom of the tea kettle. He promised to have his uncle translate it for me that evening. Next, I stopped by to see a scientist friend of mine. I gave him the tea kettle and asked him to analyze the composition of its metal and any residue it might contain. The scientist informed me a thorough examination would take a couple of days. I told him I didn't have a couple of days. Or rather, Roger's Doppel didn't have a couple of days. I wanted to have this case wrapped up airtight before that little guy expired. I owed him that. The scientist told me he'd do what he could. 31. Roger's hop, hop, hop up the walk to Little Rock's front door turned his stream of questions into a verbose roller coaster.
How did you know Little Rock would get a phone call?
Read his words on his upspring.
How did you know who it would be?
They read on his descent.
How did you know Little Rock picked up a package?
Up.
Do you know what's inside it?
Down.
What do we tell Little Rock once we're inside?
Up.
Who does the talking?
Down. I got motion sick just reading him. I slapped my hand over his mouth to shut him up and scrambled his wavy words so Little Rock wouldn't see them and get wise to our play. I shoved the rabbit behind me where he wouldn't get in my way and rang the bell. Little Rock opened the door and stood there staring at me, with his mouth open about as wide as first hole on a championship putting green.
"Yes? Oh, valiant, wasn't it? What are you doing here?"
He fluttered a hand.
"I'm so sorry, but I'm just in the middle of something. Could you possibly come back later? Say, tomorrow. Tomorrow would be just perfect. See you then."
He started to shut the door on me, but I pushed past him into the house. Roger bounced along after me, and Little Rock brought up the rear.
"Here now, exactly what do you think you're doing?"
Little Rock babbled.
"You can't come in here."
"Too late," I countered. "I already am in. And you're in, too. In deep, serious trouble." Little Rock's Adam's apple gulped through a series of moves good enough for first place in a yo-yo tournament. "I know what you've got going with Carol Masters and Sid Sleaze," I stated.
"I don't understand what you mean," he retorted lamely. "Sid Sleaze? Who's Sid Sleaze?"
"He's the guy whose office you visited not half an hour ago." I pointed at Roger. "Want me to have my assistant here play back a videotape of that event?" Roger showed some of that quick wit that made him such a hot property in the comic biz and picked up on my bluff.
"I can have the machine set up and rolling in 5 minutes, Chief," he said.
Little Rock looked from one of us to the other for the slightest sign of a shuck, but both of us held fast.
"Oh, that Sid Sleaze," he said finally. "Of course. Now I know who you mean. I had some minor business dealings with the man. Nothing significant. He wanted to buy some things from the gallery."
I put out my hand. "Let's have it."
"Have what?"
asked Little Rock. "The envelope you got from Sleaze."
"What envelope?"
he said, with an air of innocence unbelievable in anybody this side of Dondi. "Come on, don't play cutesy with me. I know what's in that envelope. You either give it to me, or I phone the cops, and you give it to them. Believe me, you got a lot better chance with me. I'm not really interested in your scam. I'm out to nab your old man's murderer. You help me do that, and I don't care if you bilk the entire Western world. But I have a hunch the cops aren't quite so open-minded. Now give." He caved in easy, but wimps like him always do. He scuttled into his den, came back, and gave me a standard 8x10 manila envelope. I opened it and unceremoniously dumped the contents onto a coffee table. As I suspected, it contained at least 36 negatives. I picked a few at random and held them up to the light. Sure enough, they were the negatives of Rocco De Grisi's missing artwork.
As nearly as I could tell, there were at least 6 sets of negatives for each piece. "Take a look," I said to Roger. "You once told me you could tell reproduction negatives from originals. Which are these?" Each time Roger held one up and examined it, he gave out with a low whistle of admiration, until there were so many notes floating around the room looked like the site of yesterday's canary convention.
"I've never seen anything like this," he said when he finished. "These are absolutely perfect. No graininess, no fuzzy images, no degradation of color. They all look exactly like originals to me."
"Want to tell us about these?" I asked Little Rock. Little Rock went to the bar and mixed himself a drink from out of a rainbow assortment of bottles that duplicated the ones he kept in his gallery office. I don't know what color he was shooting for, but he built and threw away 3 drinks, all of which turned out jet black, before he finally gave up and tossed down a straight shot of plain, garden-variety see-through vodka. Carol Masters and I vowed to avenge ourselves on my father for the unjust way he treated us, so we decided to sell a number of pieces we removed from the gallery. "That's a rather genteel way of phrasing it," I said. "You didn't just remove them. You stole them, plain and simple." There was no way he was going to convince me otherwise, but by golly if he didn't try. "We did not view ourselves as criminals, Mr. Valiant. We took Carol's works, and hers only. We both felt she was entitled to profit from their increased value. We saw nothing morally wrong in her doing so, and in my getting a cut for helping her." "I know a rabbi, 6 ministers, and a pope who might give you an argument on that, especially when you take into account what you eventually did with them." "Still no mea culpa."
"That was Carol's idea, not mine. Carol's. Rather than sell them once, she reasoned, why not duplicate them and sell them multiple times? I told her it was an admirable idea, but would never work. We had the original negative, so we could easily produce more prints, but each framed work had to include both a print and the negative it came from. Since we had only the one negative, that was impossible. We couldn't use a normal dupe neg. Any knowledgeable collector would spot it in an instant. That's when Carol suggested Sid Sleaze. Carol had worked for Sleaze years earlier, when he still went by the name Baumgartner. He kept in contact with her through the years, trying to get her to go back to work for him. One day, over lunch, he told her about a new process he'd developed to reproduce negatives so perfectly that not even an expert could tell duplicates from originals. If it worked as well as he led Carol to believe it would, it presented the perfect solution to our problem. Carol approached him with our proposal. In return for a flat fee per piece, he was to take our original negatives and turn out duplicates in limited quantity. I framed the duplicate prints and negatives together, and Carol signed them. We then sold them as originals through shady dealers like Hiram Toner.
The word must have gotten around that these pieces had been stolen from your gallery.
To be sure. The police circulated photos and complete descriptions throughout the world.
Your fencers have any problem finding buyers under those conditions?
None whatsoever. There are any number of collectors who care not a whit about a work's provenance. If they want to possess it, they will, stolen or not.
How many of these duplicates did you sell?
We limited ourselves to 15 copies of each work. Any more than that, and we ran the risk of exposing our ploy. Our buyers weren't about to display stolen works openly, but they might show them to a close friend or two. Sooner or later, someone was bound to see the same supposed original in 2 collections. At that point, values would plummet, suspicions would rise, and angry buyers would begin tracing their way back through their dealers to Carol and me. An altogether ugly situation. We fully intended to be out of it before that happened.
You planned to use the money from this deal to bankroll the startup of your own cartoon syndicate?
Yes. In fact, I had already approached my father through an intermediary with an offer to buy up the contract of a toon I could use as the cornerstone of my new enterprise.
That intermediary, I said, was Sid Sleaze, going by his real name, Sid Baumgartner.
Correct, said Little Rock.
The character you were going after, I continued, was Roger Rabbit.
Correct again. But father refused to sell. I consider myself a very astute judge of toon talent, bragged Little Rock. I told father many times that Roger Rabbit was one of the most talented toons in the DeGreasy stable. I told father over and over that Roger should get a strip of his own. Father refused to listen. He wouldn't star the rabbit, nor would he turn him loose. I always suspected it had something to do with Jessica.
You mean Rocco used Roger to hold on to Jessica?
Interrupted Roger. Why did that rabbit refuse to give up his dogged belief that Jessica loved him when anybody with even half a brain could tell otherwise?
So long as Rocco kept the rabbit, he kept Jessica too?
So it appeared, said Little Rock, sending Roger's spirits soaring to the moon.